Hospitalitychain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, Hospitalitychain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace. Welcome back to part two of my conversation with Pedro Mrejai. In part one, we talked about the massive scale of industrial food manufacturing, pumping out about 2 million pounds of mayonnaise a day and vertically integrating factories. But today we're shifting gears completely. We're talking about what happens when you walk away from managing $1.4 billion in a portfolio to bet on yourself. Pedro takes us through his midlife crisis, move to Mexico City, and corporate habits to unlearn, like checking your email every 5 minutes. I know it's something I do all the time. To actually survive as a founder. We also get technical. We dive into why your favorite Excel spreadsheet is actually a liability trap waiting to blow up your business, and how AI tools like Nano Banana and Claude are changing the way we work right now. Plus, he gives us his $100 million idea for saving the chocolate industry in 2026. This is a masterclass in operations, tech, and taking the leap. Let's get back into it. Okay, we're into the last 5 months now. Decide, you briefly touched, you know, at the end of your career, kind of with the Unilever. Again, you're leading, you know, this massive team, $400 million of business, 15% year growth, all of this stuff. You know, that's a career that I think a lot of people would say, hey, I'm never leaving this ever. Like, why would I want to leave this? Like, this is cushy. This is great. I've got continuous improvement. The company's doing stuff for me. Why in August was the time? Was that itch? I think you mentioned briefly the itch to be like, I want to work more with smaller businesses. Put it all together of like, okay, I made the decision and I'm going on my own.
Yeah. First, I will start with my decision to leave Unilever and to be on my own started long before August. So anyone who's considering it, I did a lot of soul searching in the year prior to that of what's right for me, what's not right for me, why do I want these things? And what I realized along the way is that I have a really big passion for coaching and supporting people through whatever change they need to get through. And at the end of the day, that's my purpose. That's who I am. That's what I love to do. I was getting to do a lot of that at Unilever, and I saw an opportunity to do even more on my own. And so I realized that by finding people like you, entrepreneur yourself, me, entrepreneur, others that are founders of CPG businesses or food businesses, I can help them grow in ways that I couldn't necessarily do with others at Unilever or even in a big corporate business. And so that was one piece of it, is that I really wanted, I've always known I've wanted that. And even in my Unilever career, you'll see my path was to get closer and closer to that kind of purpose where I could coach and mentor and help more people with their own career plans, with their own growth. Another aspect is I've always wanted to own my own business. Like, anyone who's an entrepreneur knows the itch I'm talking about, where you're like, it's just in the back of your head at all times. Like, I want to be able to run this myself. I want to own it. It's just, I don't know why. It's just something I've always wanted. And I think it sparked, there were two sparks in my life that triggered that for me. One was coaching the Ultimate Frisbee team that you mentioned before. That was my team. And I got to run and coach it as a bunch of with my friends. And it felt very much like this thing that I built. The second one was when I helped my buddy start the data analytics company during my MBA. I could see what it was like to really start a business and like to go from zero to one. And I loved it. I just ate up that energy. It was really, really fun. And that itch just couldn't go away from me. So I had to scratch that itch. The third thing is that my wife and I were going through a midlife crisis. Like, let's just name it what it is. We were hitting that midpoint in our life. We have two kids. One is 4, one is 2.5. We'd always wanted to live abroad. We have our own goals in life. My bucket list included living abroad, learning another language, along with many other things, owning my own business. And so we're like, well, we're not getting younger. Our kids are getting older and they're going to need more stability soon. So if we don't get this done now, when? And so, well, my wife being the wonderful woman that she is, she was like, yeah, let's just do it. Like, what's the worst thing that could happen? Well, worst thing could happen is that we're homeless and we're broke. But we saved up money. We planned it out. Like I said, I started this like long before we really got to this point of being able to meet a few goals at once. And so I purposefully structured and started my business at the same time that my wife and I were fulfilling our personal dreams of living abroad, because I could build that flexibility into how I build my business. And now I'm starting to get into more and more helping people that have their own dreams and fulfilling them through using my expertise that I already have from Unilever and all the other stuff that I've done.
And you can always go back. That's what I've been telling myself, you know, being on this journey and this ride. Like, if I want to go back, I could go back. All I got to do is make a couple phone calls, put a couple things out, and somebody's going to say, hey, I got a home for you. And you can go back. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no harm, no foul if you try and it doesn't work. But you got to give yourself a chance, too. I think a lot of founders and entrepreneurs, and it depends on what space you're in, right? If you're CPG and you're burning cash, you have obviously a finite runway, depending on how much cash you can bring in. But other things, depending on what it is, service-based, et cetera, you have a little bit more of a runway if there's no capital, no overhead, et cetera. Are there any like corporate habits that you had to unlearn, you know, going out on your own, or were they always there and you didn't really, there wasn't a whole lot?
No. One of the ones I've really unlearned is checking my email every 5 minutes, because I was running a huge supply chain. And so actually, as weird as it sounds, like email and Teams and messages, like urgent responses were required for a lot of things.
Mm.
But now I'm running my own business and like the urgency value is much different. Okay. Urgency is not that I'm going to miss a shipment to, you know, the Bahamas or something, like, right. Okay, we miss a shipment, we miss a boat, like we're delayed big time, a customer's mad. Now it's like, oh, it's urgent to respond to Jeff's email on Monday, sometime this week, you know, like things like that, where it's like, it's just different. So that habit of like clicking refresh and like always having my phone notifications up that were important. And I was always the type of person that I was very deliberate about what can notify me. I've just like flipped a lot of those off and I've had to shift gears towards being more creative with that deep work. And that's a corporate habit that I picked up over the years of Unilever, of just like, I didn't have that creativity because I didn't need it for my job. My job was fulfilling strategy and operations and the day-to-day stuff that were a combination of many people's creativity versus just my own. And so that aspect of creativity was really different. The second piece that I already had from my years of Unilever, because I was been working from home for 4 years. Yeah, 4 or 5 years, 3 years, something like that. I've been working home for a while. I've already created habits in my life to keep me productive and happy. So for example, every morning when I wake up, I take a walk before I start work. Every evening when I finish and close up my computer, I take a walk. And maybe I'll still work in the evening, but I have the end caps of my day, because that helps me separate my brain and turn it off and shift into home mode to be with my kids and my family. And that habit for me personally has been incredible. And I will never stop doing that, because it just helps me shift my mindset. And that's one that has carried on from Unilever and from my corporate life, that without it, I think I'd be not nearly as successful of an entrepreneur.
How long are your walks?
I'm usually in the morning, 15, 20 minutes, in the afternoon, 30 to 45, depending if my kids come with me. If they want to come with me, I'll walk for an hour. We'll go to a park or something.
But let's say kids aside, because obviously the tension's usually fully on kids. Any hacks, habits that you're doing like while you're walking? Like for me, it's obviously, in being in Chicago, it's the drive to in and in from, if I'm not working from home, you know, because it gives you that like separation. It's like, okay, I've left one place and now I'm in another and I'm in another zone. But anything you're doing like on your walk, or is it just taking in nature?
No, I love audiobooks. So first, I love to read. Second, with young children, I don't get time to read. I'd say maybe 5 or 10 years ago, pre-children even, I started listening to audiobooks, and man, I can't stop. Like I'm cutting through 1 to 2, maybe 3 books a month. And I listen to a wide variety of audiobooks. I do podcasts too. I like the long form ones, like what we're doing here, as well as others that I also subscribe to. But I'm not like the podcast freak that's got like 7 or 8 on subscription. I like pick and choose and supplement with like audiobooks that I want to learn about industry, business, some fiction, things like that. And so it's a moment for me to reset, re-strategize, depending on what I'm listening to, or just like get lost in, you know, the 3-body problem sci-fi books or something like that.
Yeah. Let's take a step back in a nutshell, and then we'll dig deeper. What is Elevate Growth Partners? Like, what's the mission? What is it you actually do? So people that are listening are like, okay, he started this company, he helps people, but what actually does he do?
Yeah. So at Elevate Growth Partners, our goal is to help small and medium-sized food businesses through a growth hump. So when they are scaling rapidly and they just don't know what to do, it's chaotic, they're not sure if they're doing the right things, we're the ones who want to get them through it. And we do it through 3 different ways. First is through process automation, process setting, then automation of, okay, let's say you have to do inventory reconciliation every month because you have 3 different 3PLs or something like that. We'll set up an automation for you, or set the process to do it and have someone do it manually. So that it can save you time every day and you can still make the big decisions that matter. Or we'll set up a process for like S&OP, for example, and automate that process so that you can decide the demand plan every month. So that's one big piece of what we do. The second big piece of what we do is we help supply chain start up a new channel. What does that mean? An example is like, let's say you're a European company and you want to start importing in the USA and you have no idea how to do it. We'll do it for you. Like, we will be there. We will help you get it started. We will help you hire a team. We'll help you train that team and then hand it back over to you, or, you know, get your team to be able to do it, teach them how to do it. We'll also help you find distributors, the importer on record, all those things that I mentioned earlier. We help you tick all those boxes to make sure you don't miss anything. And the third thing that we do is fractional services to get you through that growth. So let's say you just grew 50% and you're not sure if you need to hire one more full-time person. Well, we can be your fractional person for an interim period of time. So let's say you need one more supply planner and you're like, well, I only have part-time work for them. We will do that for you. We can have 50% of a supply planner because I can spread it across a few clients. But the key is that we don't want to do it long-term. So a lot of the fractional services want to be with you for a year, 2 years. Our goal is to only be with you until we can get either automate your process so that you don't need that person, or help you hire the person and then hand it over to you, train them and hand it back to you. So we're like a service provider that wants to leave as quickly as possible, because that means we're doing our job and really teaching you how to do it. The other unique thing about my company is that we are success-based. So we do all these things, fractional services, everything, but off of deliverables, not off of, you know, you just pay us this monthly fee or hourly fee. I don't ever really want to work hourly, and I don't really want to just do strategy. I won't take just a strategy project. It has to be strategy plus execution, because so many things happen during execution that change. And so we build our success metrics based off of our mutually agreed goals. Usually that's volume growth. Usually that's moving the, or starting up the new supply chain, first shipment, let's say, or that could be reducing the time spent on this process by 20 hours a month. You know, once we hit those goals, then we get paid. So people, our clients, know that we are truly in it with them rather than just trying to eke out more hours and suck on that revenue model. Because I think I'm a big believer in aligning incentives for both sides. And when you do, I think both can be very successful.
Yeah, it's most people don't think about it that way. But when you bring success, you know, and your client sees it, then obviously they're going to want to pay for it, right? Why wouldn't you want to pay if you have a growth of XYZ or whatever, again, the project is, and it's successful? Why wouldn't you want to reward, you know, the person that helped you, and you're not worried along the way of like, okay, I'm being nickel and dimed, and oh, we got on a call today for 10 minutes and I got billed for an hour. And then I sent him a text message and I got billed for another hour, the whole lawyer model. But when does a founder, like, when do they know to hire their first person in ops? Because, you know, bookkeeping, that kind of stuff, that's obviously usually the first things to get sourced to somebody, which makes sense. But when it actually comes to ops, when is it time and how do they know when to hire that person?
The trigger I tell every founder is when you are focused on ops and not the rest of the business. That's the right time. Usually that's quite early in the journey, earlier than most founders think. But the moment that you're losing half your time, 70% of your time to the operations of fulfilling orders or going through your supply plan or dealing with the CM, that's the trigger. And it's way earlier than a lot of people believe. Now, there are ways to get ops people in where you don't have to hire full time, and you can have a clear process set. You can even get virtual assistants to do a lot of this stuff. But a lot of people don't think of it that way. The reason I say that is because founders are the best proponent of their business. They are the best salesperson for their brand. They are the best person to do so many other things than just the day-to-day slog of fulfilling orders. So I always believe that a founder's best return on investment is not to be doing ops. Save that for the people like me that love this stuff and can do it faster and can automate it and make it easier on you in the long run. Like, because then you'll be happier, we'll be happier, we'll all, at the end of the day, win.
Okay, I got to touch on the subject of Excel, because it was my baby for many, many years. I learned it inside and out. And this was before I learned it before AI was really what it is today, where it's a powerful tool, it's integrated into everything. Mm-hmm. So Excel, this was the days where you're using Power Queries and those type of integrations. You've said, you know, spreadsheets go from helpful tools to liability traps. Why?
So first, I was the same as you, Jeff. I love spreadsheets. I still love spreadsheets. I do so many things in them. And like Excel, Google Sheets, I don't care. I'm in it. I love it. They're so flexible and they do things so nicely. But big caveat, they break when you have to start managing version control, or when they get really heavy, or God forbid you hit the row limit in Excel. If you've ever hit the row limit, you know what I mean? Like you click the macro or calculate button and then like poof, your computer just blows up in a puff of smoke. You know, that's first, that's probably too late to shift away from spreadsheets. You've gone off the cliff. As soon as you're starting to manage versions or lots of people are editing it or you don't have a single source of truth, that's when those spreadsheets become a liability. Where do I see this happening most? Number one, managing money. Every time, if you're managing money in a spreadsheet, you are at risk of losing money. Like literally not knowing where the money is. Not like, oh, I'm bleeding cash. Like, I don't know if this person owes me money or that person owes me money, and I don't know if I've charged them yet. If you're doing those types of things in a spreadsheet, you might be in trouble. And that's a good time to start automating these processes and getting them into the right software tool, whether that's an ERP, I know that's a scary word, but ERP, or whether that's just a simple accounting software, or even just like a simple automation that can do this stuff for you and output a static report like a Power BI dashboard. Those types of things will keep that liability away from a spreadsheet that can break very easily. Now, those spreadsheets are still very useful and flexible. And so I've seen many companies plan their supply chain on spreadsheets until they are 50 million, 100 million, 200 million a year. It is possible if you're sophisticated enough and you understand the limits of spreadsheets and you have someone really talented. I challenge any of those companies to think about how talented that team is and if that talented team could do that in a true structured database instead. Why not just program your own if you're programming it in Excel? In which case it's much more stable. So those are some of the things that I think about when I start to do this, but every business that's starting out, if you're listening, start with a spreadsheet. Don't build something fancy because you don't know your process yet. In order to get out of a spreadsheet, you have to know your process and it can't change too much. So start with the spreadsheet, let it grow, get a little scared of managing in a spreadsheet and then call someone for help.
I went through that and to your point, seeing a company, like I went in somewhere and saw, and I was like, wait, all of our recipes are in spreadsheets? All of this, it kind of blew my mind because I think at the time it was like $30 million revenue, $40 million, something like that. And I go, we run everything off of Excel spreadsheets. And they're like, yeah. And I was like, what do you mean? And coming from a large company, you know, I was at Aramark prior. I was like, no, we have a whole system that it does all of that work for us. It calculates our forecasts and it scales for us and it menu develops and blah, 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 blah. And they're like, No, we just use this Excel file. And then having a little bit of knowledge, I started looking through it and inventory was done in Excel. That's where it got scary because I was like, wait, how are you keeping pricing updates on thousands of SKUs, right? And people having the correct pricing. And what was the last pricing? Because commodities go up and down. They don't stay the same. So you're inventorying now at a stagnant level. I had a very hard time wrapping my head around how they were doing this. And I think my first inventory, I said, I'm not doing this. I go, this is a waste of my time. I go, I'll give you a ballpark of what we brought in because we haven't really been in service yet. But it didn't make practical sense for me to go count things. And then you have the dollar evaluation that could be completely way off. So we worked through using a system through one of the partners we had. And I was like, this is much more sophisticated. At least we know for the bulk of our purchases, 80%, that we have the correct pricing. And it matches up to their correct SKU. The other 20%, it's not the end of the world. You're probably going to be off by, depending on the size of the account, you know, 0.5% to 1%, depending on how good you were at managing it all. But I saw it first place, and it is mind-blowing how you can run a business of that size. I mean, just what I've started. I mean, I love spreadsheets, but just like your point of accounting, I was like, there's no way I can't keep doing this. And I just bought some cheap accounting software. It's not like I got a ton of transactions going in and out. I need just something that can then link up to my bank accounts. I can keep things balanced and I don't need to think about it because trying to manage a spreadsheet, well, did I balance that? Did I receive that? Did it go out? Giant nightmare, which kind of leads us into AI and automation. First, general thoughts on the topic, and then we'll get in more specific.
Generally, so first, I love this topic. It's one of my favorites to talk about. Generally, with AI and automation, it's going to change the world. It already has been for quite some time. I think another little known fact, but AI and machine learning have been in place in supply chain for many years already, 5-10 years. But it's now blowing up because it's much more known in the news because of large language models that have come about. But general machine learning capabilities, I've used them when I was, let's see, it would have been when I was at the mayonnaise factory. I used a machine learning model to predict the fill rates on a filler. And that would have been 6 years ago, 7 years ago. So these these tools have been around for quite some time. And I think a lot of people don't realize it because we just went over a tipping point and it got a lot bigger, a lot faster than what a lot of people expected. But now it's easy to see, not easy, I should say, but you can start to see a lot of the use cases for it that are really going to change how we do work, completely transform how we do work. And I'm talking specific to supply chain operations and fulfillment and things like that, because you can now have a conversation with like an AI agent that can tell you what your fulfillment plan, that can tell you your inventory, tell you where mistakes are maybe in it, or say to you like, no, actually, this shipment's coming in at this time. Here's the inventory fulfillment you need to do. And oh, hey, Jeff, you forgot to update this line in this spreadsheet because I don't see an update or a sync in the last, 2 hours or something. So these things now, the power is actually in your brain instead of like what you can transition to the keyboard, because your brain can be actually just funneled straight into what you can automate into AI. And in supply chain, it's an incredibly powerful tool.
Yeah. What are low value tasks founders should be trying to automate?
Man. Call me. I got a lot of them. So my favorite one that you touched on is inventory reconciliation. Like, number one, first and foremost, like, why are you doing that on your own? There's no reason. Okay, fine. It's in a spreadsheet. We don't have to argue about that one, but AI can reconcile that for you in the spreadsheet, or even just a simple automation can do it for you. You can do it on N8N, on Parabola. There's many tools out there that can do this type of reconciliation on a regular basis. So very low value task where like every month you need to check your inventory, shipments out versus shipments in, and what's the inventory supposed to be at versus what it's at today. And then did you bill everything that went out? Like, those are simple questions, but it usually takes someone 4, 8 hours, 12 hours a month to figure that out.
Mm-hmm.
That is super low value work, easy, low hanging fruit. Another one is, let's say you're building a supply plan and you say, I need 10, 20, 40 of each of these SKUs because that's what my demand is, that's what my orders are. And therefore, I need to plan out these factories to make these SKUs in this order based on my inventory model. Usually it's someone going through some formulas in a spreadsheet, and then they say, okay, now let's explode that out into the bill of materials and all of the things that the factory then has to order. Most people have gotten sophisticated enough to at least program that into a spreadsheet. Ones that go two steps further, they don't program it into a spreadsheet. They program the rules into an AI agent. And then every month they just come back to that agent and upload the 3 or 4 documents that are updated and say, make my plan for me. And so they were the person who does it. It's still a supply planner. It's still someone who has to figure out like, is this right or is this not? But the hours of work just went from like 4 hours down to one.
Right.
Because before they were compiling everything for 3 hours and then 1 hour analyzing, is this right? Now they compile for 5 minutes because they plug it into this AI gem that they've built, or ChatGPT project or whatever, and it just spits it out on the other side. Now, one of the big mistakes I see a lot of people doing is they're not fact checking or verifying that the AI is doing it correctly along the way. And so you have to ask questions of the AI, like, what are your assumptions? How are you fact checking? How are you verifying? Making sure it doesn't make mistakes and doing those spot checks. But once you get it really set up correctly, like, those two examples are very easy, low-hanging ones to just reduce the amount of time it takes people to do some of these tasks. We could spend 2 more hours if you want. I could give you lots more. But those are the ones that I see most impactful to small businesses.
How much AI should, a founder or an entrepreneur be using, right? I know there's a CPG world, but in general, there still needs to be obviously a human element to things, like to your point, fact-checking, mm-hmm. making sure. There's plenty of times I plug something in and as, having chef background, I'm like, no, that is completely false. There's no way that is correct. And I'll say, you're wrong. And it'll say, actually, you're right. I was wrong. I made an assumption. And then it corrects it. And I'm like, okay, well, that is correct. So maybe a two-parter is, when is you're automating too much? And then two, how do you know the right questions to ask in depending on the subject to know that you're actually making sure that it's giving you the facts?
Mm-hmm. It's really hard. It's really hard to know when is too much, quote unquote, too much for AI, and when you really have to fact check. I think there's a few parts of it. One part is doing exactly what you did, which is like, find an expert. You're the expert from a chef perspective. Who's the expert from a supply chain perspective? On and on and on, which is why I also tell people, like, you're not going to get replaced by AI, at least not in this decade, maybe. You're going to get replaced by someone who uses AI.
Mm.
That's really what's actually going to happen. So if you don't start to use AI, I personally use it every single day. for many different types of tasks, but every day I'm on one of the AI agents or one of the AI tools in some way or another. You've got to learn to use it because it just saves so much time. Now, when does it get to be too much? My opinion is it's too much when you aren't adding your own perspective and experiences to that AI tool. And you can do that in many different ways. When it's a repetitive task like supply planning, okay, how much do you really need to add your own perspective? Probably at the beginning and then a little bit for each check. And you can like whittle that down as time goes on and you get more and more confident with it to the point where I've seen AI tools making decisions for supply chain experts on how much inventory to make, what to send to contract manufacturers and on and on and on. So I've seen that limit get tested and I've seen it run successfully and unsuccessfully. And the ones that do it successfully have put all of the guardrails in place. Mm-hmm. The ones that do it unsuccessfully thought they put the guardrails in place and they didn't cover every edge case. And so you have to purposefully understand and build those guardrails so that your AI doesn't do exactly what you did, like give you some crazy recipe that quadruples the amount of eggs in a mayonnaise and expects it to still emulsify. Like that's a really nerdy example, but like it could happen. And so it's about setting up the right guardrails along the way, which that takes an expert. Actually, the expert could be an AI expert helping you along the way too. Yeah. Just set up different roles for them. But you need that expertise to be built in and the checks to go on top
of it. Yeah, I tell people like search up prompt engineering. Like that's what you need to learn. Like if you learn prompt engineering, that's setting the guardrails. That's telling it here what potentially depending on the project. Like that's what I love about some of these agents is you can have it by project, by specific thing. And so it can weed out everything else and know these are the rules for this. And you can be very specific. I mean, you can get very granular in which it will spit out exactly what you asked for it. What is your favorite right now? Out of they constantly are leapfrogging. Where do you sit? I know I just switched over back to Gemini. I'm finding more value, especially from the generative with Nano Banana.
Oh my God. Nano Banana is amazing.
Isn't it? And
it is.
And especially in my world, right? When somebody wants to see a dish, I don't have to actually go out and make it. Like right out the bat, mm-hmm. I can say, here's what it can look like. Is this what you're looking for? And now I don't need to waste my time, supplies, getting it, put it all together. Mm-hmm. I can say, and if it is, then we can go and recreate this. But is this what you're looking for from a dish? And I challenge people. I'm like, it's been just transformative from what I do. And again, from recipe planning and development, there's a book called Book of Flavors. And before, it's sitting right over there. You would just flip through it and you'd be like, okay, I want to do pork today. You'd find pork. Okay, what matches up with pork? Okay, apples pair really well. Okay, well, why? And now let me go to apples and let me figure out, what kind of apples do I need to serve, right? There's so many varieties, right? It's all now inside of it. And if you don't know, you can literally load an entire book if you have the PDF of it and say, this is the reference guide I want you to use because I want you to follow the rules of this book. And it will follow the rules of that book.
It will.
And tell you exactly what you would be looking up. And a lot of people just look at me and they're like, well, that's taking the creativeness away. I go, I'm still fact checking it. I'm still in control of what the final thing is going to be. It's just helping me ideate. I don't need to be in a room full of 10 other cooks or culinarians to say, what do you think about this? And how would that work out? And if we cooked it this way, what would the texture be? It's going to give me that and I can play it all out in my head and kind of figure that out. So I guess going back to the root question, what's your favorite right now?
Yeah. First, I love the rabbit hole you went down because I've been through it so many times. And actually, a funny recent story for me on the other side of it is my own business strategy. Like I've been toying with having to change it. And it was last Sunday night, I was like kind of like spiraling myself down this hole of like, oh, I have to change my business. This is working. This is not working, blah, blah, blah. My strategy is all messed up. And I was like, let me go to my AI agent because normally I call my mentor. Like I have two or three mentors that like help me through these problems, but it's Sunday night. Like I'm not just going to pick up the phone and call him because like he has a family. So I was like, okay, let me go to my favorite AI agent for business strategy. Claude, by the way. So I'm answering your question in parts. Claude is my current favorite one for cerebral conversations as well as word content generation. I think it does the best for those types of things. I'm really enjoying their Opus, I think, whatever the highest tier one is. And so I went to it and I loaded in my previous business strategy, what I'd written for it, some information about me and context of my company and blah, blah, blah. And I said, just have a conversation with me and help me through this as my business mentor. And oh man, Jeff, you wouldn't believe it. 30 minutes later, I was like, clarity in my head all of a sudden. Mm. And my wife asked me, she's like, I mean, that's great, right? But isn't it like reflecting back on you, what you thought? And I was like, yeah, actually it is in a good way. In the sense that it helped me clarify the actions I needed to take. And then I checked those against, like, does this really make sense for the feedback I'm getting from clients and consumers and on and on and on. And then I still have the action follow-up of, like, I still got to call my mentor this week or next week and, like, ping it off of him also, just like the ideation. But it cuts that time down so much. So that's a really, I think, a similar use case to yours and a different function of what it can do. My other favorite is Nano Banana. Like, man, the images it can make now, that update just crushed it. Absolutely crushed it. Anything you can dream of comes out in that thing. And like, man, I got crazy dreams and it still does it.
Oh, yeah. And the fact that it can, I don't know the term, but the ability for it to remember is, yeah. I don't know what there's an actual term for it, where it can remember and you can then change out. Like, so if I say, I want to put this, let's just take a dish. All right. I've got braised short ribs with carrots and polenta. Okay. I don't like the way the carrots are. Keep the dish exactly the same, but I want you to take the carrots and move them to 12 o'clock in a horizontal position. It stays exactly the same. The other models would completely regenerate the entire picture. Yeah. And you're like, no, I wanted to keep that part. I really, really liked what you did there. And none of the other models that I've played around with could do that. Whereas this could keep that and then literally move the one piece that you wanted. And you're like, that's all I needed. This is amazing.
Mm-hmm. It is. That the most recent update for Nano Banana Pro, like, that's what really took it over the edge, I think. I bet the others will catch up because, like you said, they're each leapfrogging. Like, previously, I've used Gemini for a long time now, and I've recently switched to Claude for some of the other aspects of it, but they're going to cross back over soon enough also. And I've used ChatGPT for like all the integrations with other tools because that's got the best integrations. Like, it integrates with my CRM really nicely. So I can ask ChatGPT questions about my CRM, and I put all my notes of all my clients in there. So like, I can literally ask ChatGPT to tell me about one of my clients and the most recent conversation I had, and it just like spits out a summary or preps me for a meeting. And it's so cool. So cool.
I know
that those things are even possible. And that's where, like, you know, my opinion, the solo entrepreneur and the solo founder, you're going to see so many more of them over the coming 5 years, because it's so much easier to be successful if you really do use all those tools. You can just leverage them and really increase your impact.
It's an amplification, just the same as if you're using it in a job and you've got coding engineer, well, you're not necessarily replacing said coding engineer. You're just taking the one task that took 4 hours down to 1 hour or 30 minutes. Yes. And now he's freed up to do X amount more. I mean, I use it as an entrepreneur. There's a lot of subjects I don't know shit about. And I don't have the money to go out and hire a bunch of lawyers and hire a bunch of people to write contracts. I just don't at this point. It does a really damn good job of putting together a baseline. At least it's going to protect me. And like, hey, pinholes, if someone were to do this, it puts it all together. And it just makes you think about some of those things. And that's the beauty of it. You can have a conversation and literally say, okay, you can put it on conversation mode and literally it'll talk back to you as if it's a person and you can start to explore and then dig into what you need and all of those things. What do you say to somebody? I still see it all the time, of people who are like, no, it's taken over the world. It makes you a mindless zombie. What do you say to those people?
Usually I ask them why they think what they think. Like, first and foremost, like, I look for that understanding of like, what's causing you to feel that way? Is it fear? Is it, you know, the fact that you're remembering when social media did this? Like, if we look at history, like, this has happened many, many times. People said the exact same thing in the Industrial Revolution when we had cars invented. People said the same thing when social media came out. People said the same thing about the internet. People said the same thing about Y2K. Like, you know, you can pin that same story on each of these revolutions, and all of them can be used for good or evil. And so I always ask those people, first and foremost, I try to help them dig through like why they feel the way that they do, because that's usually you can find out what experience they had that was either negative or impactful to their life that makes them closed off from those types of changes in the world. And also, like, to those people, I say, whether you like it or not, it's happening. Whether I like it or not, it's happening. And so your feelings are valid and great, and we can't stop it. Like, the train is already going. And if you look at some of the key AI leaders out there that are running these companies, like, they are scared. They're scared of AI becoming sentient and understanding what it's doing and being able to make some major impacts on the world that are negative, and they're still running their companies. And so I usually look to those that I believe are experts in the field, and they're doing both of those things. So like, they're pushing the boundaries and moving it forward, but at the same time, they're very cautious with how they move it forward. And so I try to reflect, those that I feel know a lot more than me about those things, and then help others see that same type of reflection from how the industry is moving. And then hopefully we can all leverage it and raise the bar for humanity in general.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of the future, we're recording this, it's December 16th, as you said, 2025, just for timestamp. What, you've been around food long enough, you've seen brands, got any food trend predictions for 2026?
Can I give you the trend predictions I want versus the ones that I actually see?
Yes, both. Both.
All right, all right. So the ones I see happening, let's add more protein to everything, more probiotics to everything, and then maybe some mushrooms in it, and we'll put it all in one drink. That's the trend that's happening now, right? Like, just slam it all in. So I see that trend happening of like, we went like simplified natural common ingredients to now like, oh, we need to add back these specific things as food gets better for you. So I find that one to be, I make fun of it, but like it, there are parts of that trend that I think are really positive, but it is a trend that I've seen all over the place. One trend I also saw when I visited Supply Side West, or Supply Side Global now, it's Supply Side Global. So it's a huge conference, 20,000-30,000 people that brings in ingredient suppliers, as well as brands from all over the world, contract manufacturers, everyone. I saw a couple of really interesting trends. One is a protein sweetener. So like you can actually sweet, it's an ingredient that you use, but it's instead of like a sucralose or like a fake sweetener, it's a zero calorie protein sweetener. And it actually interacts with the sweetness receptors on your tongue a little bit differently. So shout out to Oobly is the name of the company that invented this, but there's a couple of them out there now. So that may be coming in 2026 if it really hits the ground running. It's a little bit different of a mouthfeel than a sucralose or even a sugar. So it doesn't like hit your tongue as hard. So it's not for everything, but really cool product. The second one I see is more alternative beverages to maybe THC or alcohol, more THC drinks, obviously too, but like even further than that, like something for the occasion of drinking in the evening with your friends, it's non-alcoholic or non, let's say doesn't change your mindset in quite the same way. That's a heavy trend. And I've seen a few different versions of it. And then more trends that I want to see are cleaner labels, cleaner ingredients in general that people really understand, and the movement towards proper labeling so that all consumers can get it. Because I there's a personal opinion, personal belief that we as a country, as United States and as a world too, we can educate consumers better on what really is healthy and the impact of the food that we're eating to our bodies, not to make people change decisions or reconsider, but just so that people have better understanding of what they're really putting into their body and what can happen because of that. That they're putting into their body. And I've seen many different ways to do it. Frankly, I don't know of a great way to do it. It's really hard to educate consumers on such a grand scale. But at the same time, I feel it's really important. And I really hope that more businesses trend in that direction of helping consumers understand the impact of their food on their bodies.
It seems to be swinging that way. I mean, at least for now, that I think enough people are speaking up and saying, tell us what is in this food. Because I think there's been enough time. And there still needs to be more time, but the effects, right? All these things were added in, what, the 80s, 90s, early 2000s. And now you've got a couple decades under the belt. And then now we're actually getting to see and do testing of like, well, what did these people eat? And I'm sure there are companies that have been doing studies on people and like, hey, eat Doritos every day for 20 years because we're going to pay you whatever. Yeah. And we want to see what the effects are. I'm sure there's somebody out there doing that because there's always a study you'll see come out. And it's like, after 40 years of studying Doritos, we found that the blah, blah, blah powder caused this. And you're just like, what? Or you'll see the commercial. Have you or a loved one ate Cheetos from the years of blah, blah, blah?
Yeah.
You know, the mesothelioma commercials. Yeah. And you're just like, oh, Jesus, am I going to be one of those that like you consume those products? And
but they find those people to study it. Like, I'm always amazed. Like, they found the guy eating Doritos every day for 20 years.
They did. They sure did.
It just baffles me.
It does baffle me. Yeah, I agree with you. And then protein makes sense too, with GLP ones on the rise. And the amount of proteins. I think you're going to see it in the grocery stores, which is crazy, right? Whole GLP-1 sections where it's like the meals or products, like, hey, these are designed for you. It's going to be crazy what that looks like. What's the biggest news in supply chain for 2026?
Biggest news in supply chain is, we touched on it, nearshoring.
Okay.
Changes in sourcing portfolios. Like, that's the biggest changes happening in the world right now. And you see it in many... manifesting in many different ways. First and foremost is the container market has like flip-flopped because a lot of containers got stuck in China. So now the empties didn't make it all around. And so container prices have like rotated around the world. So some things are more expensive and less expensive. And those container prices, I think, drive a lot of consumer pricing that people don't realize.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think if you follow container pricing, you will see 6 to 12 months later, consumer pricing change accordingly. So for example, a lot of toys and let's call it durable consumer goods come from China, along with a lot of industrial supplies too. Those container prices are starting to go down now because there's not as many containers coming from China and over. So that means consumer pricing of those will come down. But then you have the flip side, which is tariffs went up on China. And so like those will likely balance out so you don't see much. But the impact of having those container prices cheaper from China means container prices are also cheaper from Vietnam, from Korea, from all of Southeast Asia. And so those products can now make it for cheaper and they don't have as many trade barriers. So I see that as one big change for 2026 is that whole pricing model. I see a big change of manufacturing getting nearshored. How much is very debatable. Is it going to be half of it, all of it, a portion of it? I wish I could tell you. I can tell you that every company needs to do an evaluation on it. It's important. And then the other big one that I see is technology becoming more and more prolific for supply chain. More and more autonomous. I don't think 2026 will be the year of autonomous supply chain, but I think it will be a slow burn to get to that point where we're going to blink one day and Amazon will be running completely AI supply chain.
Yeah.
And other big companies will too. Like it's coming. I can see it coming. Like you can see this wave like crashing towards you from way out in the ocean. You know it's going to hit the shore and you know it's going to be huge and you're just not sure when. But I think that tipping point is coming sometime in the next 1 to 3 years. And I personally want to be ready for it, and I want everybody I work with to be ready for it too, because it's going to be impactful.
You can either be prepared for the tsunami, or you can get caught up when it hits the shore and just get your face ripped off. You get a pick.
Yep.
Okay. If I gave you $100 million in venture capital today, you couldn't start a tech company, had to start a food brand. What specific product category would you attack? Where's the sleeping giant?
Well, let me answer two different ways. One, not a sleeping giant, but I would love to do mayonnaise again. It's not a sleeping giant at all. It's a giant already. Now, to really answer your question, I think, and let me think about that one, the sleeping giant and food. With $100 million, I think you could change the face of chocolate. Let me explain a little more.
Yes, because now that you say that, I've got a couple of thoughts as well. Go ahead.
Yeah. So chocolate prices have been on the rise because the source of chocolate is getting smaller and smaller. Why is the source getting smaller? Because of global warming. Why is global warming impacting that? Because of all these emissions and blah, blah, blah. And farmers don't have good agreements and things like that. So with $100 million, like this is a lot of money. You could actually go and contract farmers years in advance, 1, 2, maybe 3 years in advance, to grow more chocolate farms where the climate is changing for the better for chocolate. Because one of the things I think we look at is like, okay, the latitude of chocolate that you can grow is shifting, but it's not that it's gone, it's shifting down, right? Like it's shifting farther and farther south. And as you get farther south, altitudes change, climates change a little bit, it's a little bit different. But there are ways to study that and maybe to start growing chocolate in a different way and breeding different chocolate seeds together or cacao seeds together to really make that a more sustainable product. And then on the flip side of it, you can also be researching alternatives to cacao. Like how can you actually make an alternative ingredient that has similar mouthfeel, similar smoothness, similar bitterness that can extend not only the life of chocolate, but also how much cacao you really have to use in some of your chocolate recipes. So I think that's a sleeping giant. Plus on the other side of it is like, there's a part in me that I love chocolate a lot. And I know how bad sweet chocolate is for me. And so I just keep moving more and more to bitter chocolate. Like I eat chocolate every single day. I try to go for 70% dark because it's slightly better. But like there's a world of better for you chocolate out there that I think we haven't fully tapped into. And there's a couple brands out on the market that I think can really grow that. And so if I'm an investor, I'm going to go back those plus start my own and see what we can do.
Have you seen what's been going on recently with the whole filled chocolate bar? Like kind of revolution.
No.
So it just started. Obviously, the one that set it off was the Dubai chocolate, right? The pistachio cream with the kanef inside of it. Well, now manufacturers are realizing that if they fill their chocolate bars with something, they don't need to use as much cocoa.
Yeah.
And it goes back to your point, the supply is lower. So, but we could still charge the same and actually more for a premium because we can say, look, we're putting something else inside of it. So they've started filling them with that pistachio cream. And they're starting to do other filled cream chocolate bars to reduce the amount of chocolate that they need to use. So I think you're on to something with that. And I think they're already looking at it. I mean, obviously, there's to your point, they're specialists in each of these fields. That's all they do is they study the climate, the habitat, et cetera. But it's definitely, it's there. I don't know down south, but at least in America, it's huge that it's coming back. And then secondly is, and I just lost my train of thought. What was the second? To your point with the percentage of chocolate, I think it's a lot like wine. And this wine, I always go back to it, right? You start sweet and then you work your way backwards. I'm the same. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't really do milk chocolate anymore as much. Like, it's just, it's too sweet. But then, you know, suddenly you start to go bitter and it's just like, this is so much better. Again, maybe it's just that retraining the palate. But okay, the final thing we got is a this or that, Chicago versus Mexico City. So I've got
four
different to end on. Okay. Chicago deep dish or tacos al pastor?
Well, first, before I answer, I'm a vegetarian, so let me preface.
Okay.
But tacos al pastor, substitute meat, let's call it soy rizo, maybe. Tacos soy rizo. Okay. And that's easy. Tacos. Every time.
Okay. Well, this
deep dish is too much cheese. Come on.
It's a lot of cheese. It is a lot of cheese.
It's a lot of cheese.
Okay. Well, this one might be a little tough, trickier, too. I was going to say a Chicago dog or a lotes.
Lotes, that one's easy. Yeah, I've had Chicago dogs, plenty of them, but a lotes is a magic food, I call
mayonnaise.
It.
Mayonnaise. Mayonnaise, baby.
Exactly. It's mayonnaise. Come on.
How do you not? Biscuits and gravy with a side of hash browns or chilaquiles?
Oh, that one's actually hard. It depends on the biscuit. So, okay. Shout out to this company, Biscuit Bitch, in Seattle. Okay. I don't know if you've ever eaten there. If you haven't, it's worth a trip to Seattle. Like, look them up, Biscuit Bitch. Jeff, it's been, I don't know, 10 years since I've had that biscuit. I still remember the moment I bit into it. Like, that is the magic of that biscuit. You put that biscuit against anything else in the world, I will pick biscuits and gravy with that. Otherwise, if I'm saying, like, just a standard biscuits and gravy in the U.S. versus chilaquiles that I get at a diner, chilaquiles every time.
Okay. And the final one, Garrett's popcorn, the Chicago mix.
Of course. You made these hard. Okay, churros, because I have a terrible sweet tooth. And Garrett's Chicago mix is like something that I could just eat for a snack. Whereas like churros, like I'm just like, I'm going to go off the cliff for today and eat like four churros with chocolate dip. And that's just going to be my sweet tooth fix for the week.
I think I have to side with you. I think Mexican food is one of the best foods in the entire world. Yeah. Like I don't, it's very hard to not. If somebody's like, oh, what do you want to get to eat? My default tacos. Like there's always a good taco shop. Yeah.
There's always a good time. And man, Jeff, you got to try the fresh tortillas here.
I can only imagine.
They are different.
I can only imagine.
They are different. I've had fresh tortillas in the U.S., in Chicago, in Pilsen, in Little Village. They're still better here. I don't know.
It's got to be the locally grown. It has to be. Because it was the same
thing. I did some light chemical engineering research on this because that's just who I am. The corn that they use here is slightly different, like a different starch content and blah, blah, blah. It's like not number two dent corn from the U.S. And they use a different amount of, what is it, lime? Like the powder that they put on it to nixtalize, make the corn go slightly moldy and like break it up. They do a different amount of that to make the corn meal a slightly different. So they dry out faster, but oh man, they have a different texture and they are better. Like I'll take my kids to the tortilleria down the street and we just get a half pound of them and they just snack on tortillas on our walk home.
Oh, I could see that. I could totally see that.
Like it's crazy. It's crazy. It's so good. And they're warm. They're steamy still all day.
I got to say, one of the best things, I mean, the best you can get in Chicago is when you get to a local like Hispanic grocery store and the El Milagro tortillas are still steaming in the bag.
Oh, yeah.
And you're just like, oh, that's I know best. I got a good batch today because there's steam inside the bag.
They're still hot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is the longest podcast I've ever done. This has been fun.
Nice. It was really fun. I enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah. So as we wrap up, where do people go? They want to learn more about you, the business, and all that good stuff.
Yeah. So first, you can email me at pedram@elevategrowth.partners, just like it sounds, pedram, P-E-D-R-O. I also have a website, elevategrowth.partners. There's no .com, elevategrowth.partners. And you can check us out there. Also, follow me on LinkedIn. That's actually the best way to keep up on us. I do post a few times a week, more insights like this. If you want to learn more, you can follow me for all sorts of stuff. I talk about everything from AI to how to manage S&OP to when spreadsheets break and fail and what to do and actually when to use spreadsheets too. So you can get lots of insights that way. And then, Yeah, that's the best way to get a hold of me. I also love to chat about supply chain or operations and how to grow your business. So if you ever just want to have a conversation and nerd out about supply chain or mayonnaise or how to make food, I'm here for it. So give me a call.
All good things, Pedram. Thank you. And if you like this episode, again, we'll see if we're going to one part it. If we'll put it out as a full episode.
Yeah, sure.
We'll see how it all goes. But if you like this longer forum, let me know. Go visit Spotify, Apple, etc. Leave a comment. Let me know. We could do more like this or other guests that you're wanting to see. And I think that's it for today. So Pedram, again, thank you so much. And until next time, we'll catch you on the sunny side.
Thanks, Jeff.
HospitalityChain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, HospitalityChain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.